it's really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, John Hanson here on this Monday afternoon in for Steve Bertrand for the Wintrust Business Lunch. And I got to say, Shawnee, I don't know if you've been looking out the window behind you, but the river, I'm surprised, not frozen over. But if you look up past the locks inside the breakers, frozen over between Navy Pier and the locks there.
It's just interesting the way that water sits there with the locks and difference really in temperature between the lake and the river. It was interesting here yesterday. I was remarking to Andy Mazur about how the river actually looked like it was flowing toward the lake.
Yes.
Everybody knows that it flows away from the lake.
Right. It's trying to revert back to the way it was over 100 years ago.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But the reason for that was there was mist rising off the water, and the reflection of that made it look like it was flowing the wrong way.
Yeah.
Or the right way.
Yeah, whichever way.
What
exactly.
You want to look at it.
Well, keep us posted, Dave.
Sure
if
will.
You see that river freeze up, you break on in with that news.
It's good to see some sunlight on the river today.
Absolutely. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, so we'll transition over nicely. We're going to talk about a lot of things. The government shutdown is going to be the main topic we'll talk about in the second hour about how businesses are trying to help out, but it's also affecting potential homeowners or buyers of new homes for the first time. So we'll chat with Elise Glink and Philip Weiss as well. But joining me now for the first half hour is Catherine Davis, reporter at Chicago Inno. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, of course, John.
How was your walk in? Nice and cold for you?
Yeah, I'm pretty chilly out there, but
it's
Chicago, so what can you expect, right?
I like that attitude, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. Well, I guess it's going to get a little better than worse on Friday. Let's jump right into a story you wrote up for Chicago Inno about Chicago startup funding, and it was slightly down last year, but not all that much, right?
Yeah, so funding in 2018 came in at about $1.8 billion. And so that was slightly down from 2017 when Chicago startups raised like about $2
billion.
Okay. But, you know, 2017 was really a record year for Chicago because that was the most that startups had raised since the dot-com boom of 2000. You know, so yes, funding was slightly down last year, but it was still a really good year. I mean, it was the third greatest year on record, right? So, you know, still really positive news for the Chicago tech scene.
When you say funding, define what that is. Is that private investors that are necessarily from Chicago, or just any money that is funneling to a startup all gets added into that list?
So it's mainly private venture capital, and so that can come from VC firms here in Chicago and Illinois, but also from the coasts, from New York or San Francisco or really wherever.
And so it doesn't matter where the source is, it's where the money is going that totals this up.
Exactly.
I was looking at your top 10, and Chicago ranks 9th. And I'm kind of surprised. I want to walk through this list a little bit just to add some perspective. Because $1.8 billion to me sounds like a lot of money. And for Chicago, that's great. But as the third most populous city in the area, to be 9th and see some of these other cities ahead of it, it's pretty surprising. I guess number one's not surprising, right?
Right. So San Francisco, you know, it's kind of the tech mecca, Silicon Valley. That's where the most capital's going. The startups there raise $45 billion.
So over 20 times more than Chicago.
That's a massive amount of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
New York, of course, you know, the finance capital of the United States, they came in second.
Third with $13 billion. So, yeah, I mean, that's still seven. That's about, you know, roughly the percentage of how many more people. The next one surprises me the most.
Right. Boston. So they raised $10 million. And, you know, this kind of makes sense, right? Because there's, you know, a lot of smart people in the Boston area,
okay.
Right? You got Harvard, you got MIT right there. A lot of people coming out of those programs, getting MBAs, starting companies, et cetera.
I'm just surprised $10 billion compared to $2 billion. I mean, it's a much smaller market than Chicago, but clearly five times as much. Then you got LA and San Diego, 4 or 5. That makes sense to me. It's near Silicon Valley, still big population centers. Washington, D.C., and then Raleigh-Durham coming in, well, I mean, slightly ahead of Chicago, with about $2.1, $2 billion. Any reason for that? Does that have to do with the location to our nation's capital?
I think absolutely. You know, also a big, you know, area where there's a lot of universities, a lot of, you know, people kind of branching out from big corporations there, government agencies, and spinning off and creating tech that they think can, you know, improve that industry that they used to work in.
Hey, we beat Austin, though.
Yeah, we definitely beat Austin. They came in at $1.3 billion.
There we go. Okay, let's move over to this real estate startup, Truss. It raised $15 million, part of that pie. This is big for this business. Talk us through what Truss is.
Yeah, so they're a commercial real estate platform. And basically, if you're a small business and you need office space, you can use Truss to search for spaces, virtually tour them online, you know, negotiate your price, and then sign the documents and, you know, close on this piece of property.
See, that's what's different. I was originally reading this. I'm going, oh, it's like Zillow, but for businesses, where you can look, you can see what pictures you want, how much they cost. But and Zillow, you can contact an agent, but you can't go through the entire process. This takes you from point A to it's done.
Exactly. So it really simplifies that process. You know, if you're a new business owner, finding real estate like this, you're probably not used to it. It's a really complicated process, and this really makes it easy.
How many spaces do they have? Is it a big platform? Are they offering a ton of different locations?
Well, they are operating in several cities, and they say they have 30,000 spaces on their platform, and so that can be co-working, industrial and retail space. So, you know, kind of a variety of places that you would need.
Do they get, how does it work with who gets a cut of what? Because I imagine the rental spaces, by posting it online, they get their business. How do they get paid out of this thing?
You know, I'm not exactly sure on those specifics, but the way that most of these platforms work is, of course, they take a percentage of each, you know, transaction that happens.
That makes sense. Continue our conversation with Catherine Davis, reporter at Chicago Inno. And let's talk about the Razor. Okay. A lot of people are interested about this. The Razor, for those of you that don't know, was the flip phone. It was a Motorola phone, right, Catherine?
Yep.
And gosh, I mean, the Razor was a little bit, my first cell phone was a little bit different. It was a Motorola, but it wasn't a flip phone. Flip phone to me was really exciting and new and brand new. Catherine, you had one, but you didn't have the one that you wanted, right?
Right. So I actually had the Crazer, which was like the thinner version of the Razor,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't come in fun colors. So I was always jealous of people that had a pink Razor. I was like, why can't I get this one?
Right. So it's a flip phone. I think it had like limited picture capabilities. I mean, it's a relic of the past, to say the least. Not that long ago, but in terms of technology, yes. But Motorola might be bringing it back, right?
Yeah. So Motorola is actually based here in Chicago, you know, if you didn't know. And they are reviving the Razor, bringing back what they're calling, you know, a foldable smartphone, right?
Okay.
And so the details of what this actually looks like are still really vague, you know, but trying to picture like your iPhone and like the you know, the classic smartphone model and how it can be a flip phone is kind of weird, but...
Right. I never really saw the appeal of the flip. I mean, it makes the only thing that's flipping a phone for that I think is really cool is because, you know, on cell phones, if you're really upset, well, back in the old day, you could hang up a phone and really make a noise. And with a flip phone, you could still at least give it some oomph when you hung up on them. Now you're just clicking your thumb as hard as you can. Have they talked about why a flip phone coming back? Has there been a demand for it? I mean, people are going crazy about this.
I know. Well, you know, the thing about the Razor is that it was a really iconic phone. People have a lot of nostalgia around
yes.
it, right? You know, it's like one of the really first popular cell phones. And so I think they think, you know, it's kind of a way to get back in the cell phone game, because a lot of people kind of criticize Motorola, you know, for kind of being behind on the smartphone, where, you know, Android and iPhone kind of push them out of the
right.
market, because they were still so focused on the flip phone.
Right.
And so this is kind of their way to be competitive again, I think.
Well, I don't know how competitive they're going to be with this device cost. What does this thing look like it's going to cost?
It costs $1,500.
Okay, that's way too much. Even the nicest new iPhones, I don't have the prices in front of me.
They're like $1,100.
$1,000. You can get a really good iPhone for $799 or $999 mm-hmm. with a pretty nice camera on it. To justify $1,500, I mean, that's not only nostalgia. They must be coming up with some things that we just don't know about yet on this thing that's meant to drive traffic to it.
Exactly. But I think they will find out pretty soon, you know, because they're reporting that they could have these phones available by February.
By next month? I mean,
yeah.
That's next week or so.
Exactly. So we need some commercials or something to come out about these and give us an idea of what they look like.
Obviously, Apple, known for their big presentation of the new phones. And in fact, if you're ever on a YouTube dive and really want to take a look back into the not-too-distant past but make you feel old, just look at the old introductions of the Apple One or the iPhone 1, mm-hmm. 2, 3. Motorola doesn't seemingly do these sorts of big announcements or rollouts. They're not known for it, at least.
No, they're a lot more low-key. You know, a lot of their business has really turned into acquiring software startups. So it's kind of interesting to see them get back into the consumer phone market.
All right, we'll have to see if the Razor really takes off. Okay, Outcome Health, we've talked about them a couple times in the past. They've had some issues about just how effective their advertising was. Why don't you walk us through just a little bit who Outcome Health is, what they do, and a little bit of that controversy that they endured.
Yeah, so Outcome Health is a big tech company here in Chicago that, you know, started this business where they put screens in doctors' offices that, you know, give ads, right? So good advertising stream for, you know, people trying to get, you know, their medications known or, you know, whatever.
You're sitting
else.
There and you're already bored and you've got some time on your hands. So the screens are something you're going to look at.
Exactly.
And you target it to people to that might be sitting there for a specific reason. Okay.
Exactly.
That makes sense. So then what was the controversy?
And so in 2017, they raised like $500 million from investors, you know, a range from Alphabet, Goldman Sachs, and then even some local ones like Pritzker Group Venture Capital. And later that year, a Wall Street Journal report revealed that, you know, they had actually kind of been misleading their investors on the effectiveness of their ads. So they ended up being sued by their investors and, you know, the CEO ended up stepping down as well as some other executives, and they've had some big turnovers with leadership.
And a startup, that can doom it. I mean, like stuff exactly. like that, a little ripple like that can really change it. They seem to have righted the ship at least by making one big announcement here recently, right?
Yeah. So last week they hired their first ever chief compliance officer. And, you know, from what we understand, this person's role is just going to be, you know, making sure that outcome is in compliance with laws and regulations, you know, to kind of prevent something like this happening again. So we'll kind of see how it goes.
Kind of like an ombudsman for a newspaper, someone that kind of has a zoom out lens look at the company and is able to, like a solicitor general in some ways, because
yeah.
I definitely don't know what a chief compliance officer was. Thanks for clearing that up. Okay, last story we're going to talk about, stay in the healthcare world, but the idea of pills. A lot of folks, medication, they're complicated. There's different dosages, different timing regimens you have to go through. I don't know how people keep it straight. Some of them might be using Groove Health, right, to keep their medication straight.
Yeah, so Groove Health is a new Chicago startup, and what they do is they make a artificial intelligence-powered mobile app that, you know, reminds you when to take your medications, lets you know if there's going to be any potential drug interactions, and just kind of keeps you, you know, on the straight and narrow when it comes to taking those things, right? Because if you don't, obviously, there can be a lot of medical issues for you down the line, but it can also be really expensive because, you know, you may develop another condition or need a, you know, visit to the emergency room, and those costs add up if you're not adhering to a medication regimen.
Well, I imagine it's not only costly for patients, but also for insurance companies, healthcare providers. They must rally around something like this.
Yeah, and so that's actually a big part of Groove Health's business. It's kind of the B2B model where they're going to be selling this platform to health partners and health insurance companies. And they're like, if you get your clients and your patients to use this, you know, it can save you guys money down the line as well.
So it's an app. It'll buzz like push notifications, kind of like we get from other apps, right?
Exactly.
The most popular push notification I have right now is Domino's. They really push things, and they're working. I got to say, each weekend I end up getting some Domino's. The point that I'm trying to make is if they can make me eat my pizza, they'll certainly help out with the pills. Do they have a lot of competition in this? Because it's a really smart idea, but it seems like something that someone has had to come up with before.
Right. Well, you know, one of their biggest competitors is actually Express Scripts. They have their own platform called Mango Health, and it's a mobile app as well, and they brand it as a personal health coach, but it reminds you to take your meds and I think, you know, some other like diet things that it'll mm-hmm. help you with. So they definitely have some competition in this space. They are pretty new and they're kind of, you know, revving up their user base, but they've raised a seed round of funding and planning to expand.
I imagine it's interesting because a lot of folks that might be taking a lot of medication, a lot of folks of any age take a lot of medication at certain times in their lives, are a little bit of an older generation. But as the baby boomers who have really adapted to iPhones, technology for the most part, are using it, they're getting an age. I mean, you have a giant market age group of people that might want to get in it. And if you download this thing once and use it for one set of pills, odds are you're going to use it again. It's a huge market for them, potentially.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody has a cell phone now, right? You know, mm-hmm. and everyone's just getting so comfortable with technology and how it works. And so I think, you know, just as time goes on, the market for this kind of product grows.
Catherine, talk to us about Chicago Inno as a whole. What kind of stories do you guys cover? Why should people visit your website?
Yeah, so ChicagoInno.com, we cover tech and startups all around Chicago. So that means the big tech companies like Groupon and Grubhub, all the way down to, you know, the companies like Groove Health that are just getting their start.
That's right. How can people find out more information?
So you can go to ChicagoInno.com, and there you can sign up for The Beat, which is our daily email newsletter.
Catherine, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks, John.
Plenty more Winter's Business Lunch coming up next on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand on this Monday afternoon. All right, government shutdown rages on day 30 of at least the partial shutdown of the government, affecting a lot of local folks in the area and all over the country. A lot of people that can't even imagine how many people are affected. Here to break down that and then how some businesses are hoping to maybe, I don't want to say capitalize, but help out their fellow federal workers, some trouble they can get into. That is Philip Weiss, the president of Safearth Shaw at Work. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, this shutdown is raging on. And you know, we hear that number, 800,000 federal workers, a lot. This thing trickles down much further than we realize, right?
Yeah. In fact, Washington Post last week did a bit of an analysis on this. And there are 10,000 companies that work for the government, that provide services, goods. Many, if not most of their employees are affected. And then you've got all the tertiary and trickle-down effects because they can't make purchases, they can't acquire services, so it's a long-term impact.
Yeah, when you talk about those 10,000 companies, so I imagine it's a matter that they don't get that PO, they don't get that order from the government for XYZ. The employees kind of sit there. Companies are built to sustain some of that, but not all of that. And that's the thing, is that this gets, I think, when you talk about the impact on people, it's rather linear at first, and then I think this becomes an exponential problem, because slowly but surely these companies are not going to be able to sustain their employment levels if they're not getting the cash inflow on the revenue side.
Right, and that's a really great insight. In some cases, it's actually the companies that have some private contracts and federal contracts that are hurt the most.
Yes.
Because if you know you're getting no business, you make radical adjustments. So I don't think we've begun to even look at or experience the long-term impacts, not to mention all those communities that are truly dependent on one or two major government-related employers.
Well, absolutely. And when you think about it, obviously folks that aren't getting a paycheck or they're working without anything, they're not going to... It's as simple as going out for lunch. They're not going out to dinner. They're trying to cut costs wherever they can. That obviously has a ripple effect. Okay, corporations can see this as an opportunity. Some are smart. I mean, look, I think there is some generosity out of their hearts, and they feel bad for some of their customers. They're trying to offer some free stuff. Clearly, getting into the headlines isn't the worst thing ever either. But this could cause some problems for those companies too, right?
That's right. It's like any kind of sudden change. In this case, it's a sudden change that a CEO or a CFO has decided is either the right thing to do or has some long-term PR or business benefits, just as you said. But like any change, you have to plan for it.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is, because a shutdown was a sudden reality, companies tried to jump in the breach and didn't always make the right decisions. We saw this actually, John, originally in 2013,
mm-hmm.
during the Obama-related shutdown, which was only 16 days.
Right.
So we're already almost double that length. Companies who tried to do the right thing or capitalize in the right way, they found without planning that they were really caught unaware or unprepared.
Is it just a matter of, hey, I'm going to offer free lunches for federal workers. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize how many people would come in. This is really going to cut into our bottom line. And while you might see a few articles about it, you're not going to see that payoff in the long run. Is it that, or is it even more complex things too?
It's both. In some cases, it's simply an inventory issue.
Yeah.
And we've actually found that this time around, some companies got smart and they assigned someone as kind of the point person on tracking inventory, reorienting resources. But you're right, it's complicated. If you're an auto repair shop,
mm-hmm.
and we've got quite a few around the country, John, that are trying to help out, those that offered free tire repairs are in far better shape when it comes to federal employees mm-hmm. affected than those that offered free oil changes. Because one requires you got to replenish the oil, and there's a lot more cost involved than a patch. So even at that level, you're seeing a difference in terms of how long you can sustain the assistance.
That's interesting also, because I feel like not all of us have a tire problem, but a lot of us just kind of have that oil change coming up anyway. So a federal worker that was gonna offer that money, they're not going there because they're offering that. They're like, oh my gosh, I was going to go anyways. This is perfect.
That's right. That's actually a conversation we've had with a number of clients. And that's what the owners were thinking. Do the oil change. It's scheduled. And then they thought about it and said, but wait a second, if someone has a tire leak, that's a real-time
issue.
That's
real-time.
We can be helping people in more meaningful ways and more sustainable ways.
Mm-hmm. I notice the reversing of overdraft fees. Banks are doing that where they get a lot of their money. I know that. Free yoga classes. I mean, there's all sorts of businesses, but you say there is a right way to do this, right?
There is. One piece is making sure that you establish sort of what you're offering, how long, how much? What are
right.
the limits and what's the duration?
Because the last thing you want is to offer it for a week, take it away, and then you get bad PR on the other end because, oh, they were offering and then they had to cut it out.
Absolutely. And you also want to have some internal controls. We actually have a client that is a catering company in D.C., and they were offering some ingredients, sort of staples to their employees from the pantry, not realizing the employees would take far more than the sugar and salt. They were taking the shrimps and the steaks
right.
and the frozen fries.
Right.
So some controls, but in a well-meaning, well-intentioned way, are critical. Having that point person, absolutely important. And then let people know what these rules are internally and let the community know. A lot of companies are getting far more business from other – a lot of companies are getting far more business from others in the community who hear about the good deed and want to pay back to that employer.
Right. Leadership, you mentioned, that's an important role here in this.
It's critical. And when you look at what CEOs are thinking, it's changed a lot this year during this administration. Many have taken on this mantle of doing more for society, being a voice of what they consider to be reason, stability, mm-hmm. respect. Even if you think about Charlottesville, so many CEOs came out with statements. We're seeing that again, John. Internally, a lot of large clients of ours are sending messages about what they think regarding
values.
Right. The shutdown was inappropriate based on one budget item. And here's what we're doing as a company. So we're seeing a lot of organizations get more political while they're getting more involved in helping federal employees.
Is that a good thing?
Well, that's a debate that's raging in a lot of corporate boardrooms, even this morning, which is to say, helping is one thing, speaking out on the issue and staking a position is something somewhat different. So we're going to see how that plays out. But that question is one that's in a lot of sort of these CEO suites today and next week as well.
Yeah, because you look at polling data on who you blame for the government shutdown, and it is true that more people blame Republicans and President Trump than Democrats, but it's not a whopping margin. There's still a giant part of our population that supports the president and his actions and what he's doing, and you really do risk the run the risk of alienating people on the other side.
Yeah, that's a great point. You got this like yin and yang.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you have the fact that companies that stay out of politics tend to have far calmer waters
yes,
when it comes
right.
to internal morale, not
right.
to mention reputation. On the other hand, if you look, there's a recent Edelman Trust survey that reported that 75% of the U.S. Sort of citizenry that was polled thinks CEOs and companies need to be taking a social stand, need to be stepping in the breach. So now you feel this pressure because
yeah.
if the government's not doing it, who will?
Right. I often wonder because both sides of the argument have boycotts all the time of this, that, because of their stance on this. I almost wonder, are we at a point now where there's too much noise that these statements that come out and they kind of get lost in the noise anyways, and really all you're risking is making some other people mad. I don't think that there's a really big push. I mean, you saw Gillette last week. I mean, that wasn't quite a political statement, but certainly in line with some things. Eventually, that gets lost in the noise. I don't know. There's got to be some of that, too.
There is. And what's interesting about that sort of that dichotomy of sort of, am I really adding to the discussion?
Mm-hmm.
Is this an opportunity for us to speak as a company, or are we just another sort of blip on the social media or media landscape? So what companies are deciding increasingly is we'll speak only to our own employees and we'll speak in a way that they understand.
Mm-hmm.
That way we're not sort of adding to the noise, but we're actually explaining our position mm-hmm. as far as we can take it.
That makes sense. Man, we could go on tangents forever. I'll try and keep you online here. In terms of companies doing the right things for federal employees, your third thing is to do it correctly, letting them know.
That's right. So that's pretty important because you want employees, as you said, not to expect too much or not to expect it to last too long. One of our clients is aerospace-related federal contractor, and they had a team of engineers that were not as busy because a lot of the employees weren't on their shifts.
Right.
And so they said, why don't you guys, engineers, electricians, plumbers, go to the homes of our employees who are either furloughed or impacted and fix up whatever's broken. So that's a tremendously
that's cool.
generous and pretty creative way
yes.
to use your own resources. Problem was, and this is during the 2013 furlough, there was an issue involving plumbing, a toilet actually,
uh-huh.
at the company during the shutdown. The water flooded and created an enormous electrical issue. The plant itself shut down, speaking of irony. And they realized part of it was we wanted to do the right thing, but we want people fixing our own toilets, not the employees' toilets, and it's going to cause a huge repercussion.
Right. So you got to be careful about that. Philip, one of the last question I was asking is the idea of, you know, I think it paid for some of these businesses to be the one of the first ones to offer this sort of stuff. But there comes a point when you lose that benefit, that PR benefit, now that everyone's doing it. Then you almost seem like someone that's just jumping on the train. There is a risk of that from a PR perspective, that if you come late to the party, if you start offering something now, you look like you're just that you're late. It's better just to not do anything at that point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important point. You may actually be at a disadvantage if you're late and if you're early.
Yeah.
I called three restaurants this morning that had offered free meals last week. And they're no longer offering free meals because there's so many other restaurants already doing it.
Yes.
And they spend an awful lot of money on those dishes. So this is a tough one to navigate. That's why having good limits, sustainable approaches, and great ways to communicate are probably the best way to balance all of this.
Philip, the president of Seyfarth Shaw at Work. Am I saying that all correctly, by the way?
Seyfarth Shaw at Work.
All right, very good. Philip, thanks for joining us here.
Good to see you.
All right, we're going to talk with Elise Klink next on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Well, guys, it looks like Sears might actually stick around after all. The hedge fund of the CEO, Eddie Lampert, successfully saved the company with a $5.2 billion bid, saving 425 stores and nearly 50,000 jobs. Okay, yeah, $5 billion is nothing to gawk at, but now everyone will be looking at Sears to see how they'll bounce back. The reason why they fell behind was because of the advancement of technology, so how will they leverage that now? It'll just be the next part of their legacy. And speaking of legacies, this year we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s 90th birthday. Of course, on MLK Day, it's a federal holiday, so a number of businesses are closed. But it's also a great opportunity to remind ourselves that at the end of the day, running businesses should be more than just profit margins and shareholder growth. We should be doing what we do to better ourselves, customers, and the business. As MLK said himself, the time is always right to do what is right. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
WGN, John Hansen in for Steve Bertrand on this Monday afternoon. Hope you're enjoying it. If you got the day off, driving around, or maybe just staying in your house today, it's a perfect day to do that. Chatting with Elise Klink, the publisher of ThinkLink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. Elise, I think the last time we chatted, you were in Hawaii. Are you in Chicago now, or are you someplace warm? Fingers crossed.
No. Yeah, I'm freezing like the rest of us sitting here in my office in Chicago today. But, trying really hard to remember that vacation from 3 weeks ago. It's hard.
I could remember how jealous I was of you, if that helps you out. Let's talk about you ThinkLink. You mentioned right off in one of your articles, what happens to real estate when the government is shut down? It's a great question because, you know, real estate, some people might think, oh, you're pretty immune from that. Those are big decisions that are planned out well in advance. Shutdown can have an effect on the real estate markets, right?
Yeah, it has. I mean, the government finally stepped in after the first 2 weeks when the mortgage industry started screaming because they had to bring another 40 IRS agents back in to process a form that lenders need to actually get deals closed. So for a while, there was some concern whether that was going to happen. But buyers are impacted. Realtors are saying that the number of home deals that are on the table that are going to be closing is down by something like 7.5%. So buyers are sort of backing away. Owners are finding that for payments, like for example, USDA loans are directly affected by the shutdown. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are saying that the government shutdown is not going to impact, but what they're doing is releasing guidelines for lenders with workaround issues that might arise when they're processing loans for federal workers or contractors. So it's all kind of crazy stuff. And then, actually, there's some 40,000 low-income families or elderly or disabled tenants who get assistance from the federal government to pay their rent from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and they could be facing some problems, especially if their housing contracts expire at the end of January and they don't get renewed because there's nobody there to do the paperwork.
Elise, I also wonder that if this shutdown, let's say, drags down another month, with, you know, you see each side right now, no one seems to be blinking in any sort of way or really coming to the table together, at least on both sides. I imagine that as this extends, it's not only people that have homes that need these loans or looking for loans, it starts to kind of permeate into our general economic well-being, doesn't it? I mean, we've never been here before.
Oh, it already Yeah, we've never been here before, and it's just awful, and it's going to be terrible for people. So I give this example of, you know, if you're a government worker and you're now going to be on your second paycheck without, right, so to a full month without any money coming in. So one thing that you might have done is you might have gotten your haircut. Well, you just won't get your haircut. You're going to walk around with longer hair, right?
Right.
But if you're the hair salon that normally gets that cash, it's never coming back. So the fact that these people are going to get their money, that's great. Eventually they'll get it back. But the money that they would have spent in the meantime would support thousands of businesses in their own area, and that money isn't going to come in. The other problem that workers are going to start facing are late fees and interest rate charges on bills that are unpaid. Now, the principal balance might have ended up getting paid, and they might have paid on time, let's say credit card debt, right? But if you can't make that payment because you don't have the cash that's in, now you've got an interest rate charge on top of what you had owed before. And you know what? They're not getting extra money to cover that. And so there are all ways, big and small, that this shutdown is affecting the economy and not for the better.
Boy, you bring up two really great points there. Because, yeah, you think, oh, they're going to get paid eventually. But you're right. If you missed 10 meals out for lunch and you that saved you $100, not saved you, you needed to save the $100. You're not going out to Panera and spending $100 the next day. That money, you're right, is gone forever. And I never thought about the idea of even if you make your minimum balance or you pay a lot of it, man, that extra $100 that you carry over from month to month, that's going to make your decisions the next 5, 6, 7 months, depending on how long. It really does impact it. At least I think you put that in a really great way. Okay. I want to, and you can read more about this at ThinkLink too, but I wanted to talk about shadow spaces in Chicago, and you kind of linked to a Crane Chicago business story. What is a shadow space?
Right. So what's happening now is when you see all of these office buildings go up, right now what you're seeing are building owners that are looking to poach tenants from one or another. And so you've got people who are claiming that, let's say, a law firm is going to be the prime tenant in their space, but the law firm is already in a building, right? Because
right.
The building's not built yet, or it's just getting built. And so what's happening is you're seeing these massive new office buildings and office constructions. They're starting to pick off tenants, and that means that eventually the space that the tenant is currently occupying, right, is going to be out, and it's going to be unleased space. And so there's projections in Crane's that more than almost 7.5 million square feet of this so-called shadow space is projected to hit the market starting in 2019 and 2020, and that compares with 6.1 million square feet in 2017 and 2018. And so, unless tenant demand dramatically scales up and very quickly, what you're going to see is that office company vacancies are going to skyrocket, and that's going to end up depressing prices, and it's going to make for a period of time where we're going to see that number continue to grow, and it's going to put pricing pressure out there. Now, that's good for companies looking to negotiate.
Right.
Not so good for building owners that have payments for themselves due to their lenders. And an easy way to think about this is McDonald's, right? So McDonald's has let everybody know it's moving out of Oak Brook, it's moving downtown, but they're still in Oak Brook. Well, what happens when they actually leave Oak Brook? That space is going to come on the market, and they're working on it already because it's a lot of acreage as well. But that's exactly what they mean by shadow space.
Elise Glink, the publisher of ThinkLink.com, CEO of Best Money Moves. Thank you so much for joining us, Elise. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure.